right, Kay. It is time for another special Patreon edition of the Red Leaf Retrocast. Joshi 2010s. And welcome to the Big Egg Joshi podcast if you're joining us 2 weeks later.
Hey, yeah, welcome, welcome.
So on this episode today, we are going to hop into JWP for the first time on this journey. Very exciting.
Yeah, a promotion that I'm very much always interested in looking at stuff, both from its past and, I guess, up to this point in the 2010s, but more in the 90s, they're kind of known for at this point.
Yeah, and if you want to get these episodes 2 weeks early, head on over to Patreon, Red Leaf Retrocast. It's $1.50 to throw in, help support this tape trading that we got to do these days, get a lot of these episodes done. And if you want to hear more about more Joshi, more retro wrestling, then the $5 tier would be for you, where I do Starcade. We got some good plans in the works, but mostly you want to hear about Kay talk about JD Star and magazine guys all the time.
The magazine guy, he was on episode one. If you got a chance to listen to that, you'll get that reference.
So that's Red Leaf Retrocast Patreon. And if you are already a member of the Patreon, well, fucking you guys are the best. Yes, this one we're diving into JWP. It's the very first time we're starting this basically on a big title change. It is JWP Mania 10 in 2010. But JWP is a promotion that has a rich history. Hey, why don't you kind of give us a little background over JWP here? But actually, I'm sorry. We have three matches in particular we're going to concentrate on. We're on the Neo 10th Anniversary Show, Neo Spectacle in Seichi Korakuen. That took place May 5th. We have a tag title match there that was of note. And then we finish out the episode with an intergender match featuring Aja Kong and one Kyoko Kimura at a Revolution Amendola kind of produce show. And we'll get into those two, but really this is concentrating on JWP. Now you can go, Kay.
Okay. So JWP, as we all know it at this point, formed in 92, was originally split off from the original JWP, which was split between LLPW and JWP, owned by the parent company, JWP Project, which would become important. That parent company would become important as we go forward. They sort of are known for your Dynamite Kansai, Mayumi Ozaki, who's sort of heading up Oz Academy, obviously. Cutie Suzuki, those are their big stars, their big three, more or less. At this point, though, they don't have Ozaki anymore. She's off doing Oz Academy stuff. But they don't have Dynamite Kansai, as she's kind of in and out of retirement. And they don't have Cutie Suzuki, as she's already retired and long since not wrestling anymore. We're sort of seeing the wave of the 2000s class coming up. We're seeing more Bolshoi, more Leon, Ayako Harayama, someone we'll talk about here that they seem to have been pretty high on for a little while there. We'll see Nanae Takahashi, who just happens to just be everywhere. But their belt was interesting because they didn't change hands very often. Very, very long reigns with very few defenses, kind of like one Gaia did.
Indeed. So that brings us to JWP Mania 10, which took place on April 18th. This took a little bit longer to get a hold of. I got my hands on a kind of title history DVD compilation. And what that entailed was kind of showing a big history of JWP title from 2001 all the way to 2011 situation. And just to give a little title history here, Command Bolshoi, Azumi Hyuga. And Azumi Hyuga was kind of the big star for JWP in the early to mid-2000s, before getting here to 2010. Had such defenses against Gami, Kyoko Harayama, about to talk about, Tsubasa Kurigaki, that might ring a bell. Manami Toyota was champion in the middle there for a little while. Azumi Hyuga then had a really long run, spanned over 2 years, eventually losing the title to Kyoko. No, if I'm reading correctly, she lost to Kaori Oniyama, but I guess the title was vacated And then Kyoko Hariyama ended up winning some kind of tournament for the title. And she went on to hold this title for over two years herself. That brings us to this show in particular. So Kyoko Hariyama is a JWP lifer. And I wouldn't peg her as the greatest worker in the promotion. But from a lot of feedback and reviews I was able to find and some talk about her, she worked really hard in the ring, and she was over with the audience to an extent.
Right. She was also over with management, or the booker, because she held that belt three times, the JWP Open belt. They didn't put the belt multiple times on people very frequently at that point. If you look at their history, a lot of one, maybe two reigns, but the bigger names usually get multiple reigns. And she's one of the few that got more than just one reign. She also held their tag belts five times. It's also kind of a big deal. They were really high on her. I think it's because of her effort and, as you said, how hard she worked.
Yeah, she wouldn't have, I would say, the gate success, come to put a value to it, as, say, Hyuga or Dynamite Kansai. But she held this company on her back. She's one of those workers. During dark times, on April 18th. Go ahead.
I wouldn't even say Hyuga was a big gate person at the time, especially because when she was reigning as champion, business was at the lowest it could ever have been.
Well,
so the gates they were
getting
weren't very. Right. But I don't know if I'd peg her for gate success as much as she maybe maintained a steady gate. That was probably more important for them at that point. No Dynamite Kansai gates, that's for sure.
No. So we're at Korakuen Hall here, in attendance of 839, so not sold out for a major show. And not really all that close, either.
Oh, but big for the time.
Big for the time, relatively.
It's a big Korakuen for them.
Yeah. Big for the time, relatively. So what we got here is our little outsider from Neo and various other promotions, Nene Takahashi, makes another appearance.
Freelancer Nene Takahashi. I guess we haven't specified her affiliation. She's not affiliated with Neo. She just shows up there a lot. She's a freelancer at this point.
Yeah.
Neo freelancer, winning a bunch of stuff.
Yeah, at this point in time, she is the current Ice Ribbon Tag Champions. They haven't quite lost the titles yet to that Jun Kasai Miyako Matsumoto tandem that we covered in the previous episode, which is really funny in hindsight.
But there's another belt with her, too, that looks purple and weird, and I don't think we ever looked up what belt that was, but it was very much a DIY glue things together belt.
You know what? It's funny you mentioned belts. These titles in these promotions are hideous.
They're cheaply made. Most of them DIY, as we're seeing with the Ice Ribbon belts, up until the Cross 60 belt when they finally made an actual title belt. And we also see with the tag belts in Neo, with the god-awful dirty yellow straps.
Just giant plate of Neo across it. It's all these belts are hideous. This is no exception. The JWP title is maybe a little bit better. It's just very basic. It's small. But let's get into this match. It goes almost 25 minutes. And of this DVD we have, you see a good chunk of the match, but a lot is taken out. And my understanding is we saw a lot of the kind of 50-50 striking that went on in the first half of the match. And a review I found says we don't miss anything, just understand that the beginning of the match was very 50-50, and it put a mindset in the fans in attendance that Nene Takahashi is on Kyoko Hariyama's level. So you could buy a title change here. And putting that in the back of an audience member's head, that Hariyama, our two-year champion, could lose the title, was very important, and it played a lot into the back half of the match, which is where we come in.
Right. I think it also helps that she had held the belt so long, they kind of needed to build somebody who the audience could believe could defeat her, since she hadn't been defeated for so long with that belt.
Correct. So that's kind of our little background on this story coming in. Why do you think they went for such a big match with Nanae Takahashi at this time?
At this point, Nanae, if you haven't told by how much we've mentioned her in these episodes, it was sort of
like every episode.
Yeah, yeah. So after her promotion closed down, you know, promotion Chick Fight Sun, whatever she wanted to call it, after that closed down, she was kind of the talk of the scene. She was the big freelancer. Not in the same way as like a Sari, but actually probably more so than like a Sari or a Hiroyo Matsumoto, because she was beating people and winning pretty much every company's belt at some point. She had held more than just six belts at once. She would just win belts and lose them and win them and lose them. She was pretty much winning everything. And you can owe a lot of that because her skill certainly wasn't why she was winning everything. There was much better wrestlers in the scene. It was who she knew. It was more so that than just her skill, because she's like above average, right? I'd say. So it's a fair assessment. She's above average wrestler. She can get a good match, but she's not a world beater. That's somebody you would expect this kind of push from throughout the scene, right?
Right.
Alone in that?
I don't think you're alone on that. I think a lot of the mindset of this era still is put the title on a credible veteran. They're clearly, to me, afraid to push this young, fresh, new talent. And we're going to get to a couple in this episode, whom I am very high on. And I can't wait on this podcast to talk about that Catch the Wave 2010 tournament we're currently in the process of watching. And it convinces me. Yes, there's a big tease. That episode's going to... I can't wait to plug that to hell everywhere I possibly can. So, Nanae Takahashi was the last All Japan Women's Champion, correct?
Yeah, she's the one to win the belt and seal it.
So, she has that credibility to her. She's not 20 years in and slowing down and broken. And I think a good example of this is a person whose music I found and played at the beginning of this podcast, Yoshiko Tamura, who's the Neo champion, and she's still champion at this point in the promotion for Neo. She's a veteran slowing down to the point where I guess they pulled her out of, or convinced her to delay her retirement to kind of hold the promotion together to an extent. So JWP... If I'm just looking at this this title history here, Azmi Hyuga held this thing forever. You have Amazing Kong, who at this point is back in the United States, and she's winding down her career at this point. Kyoko Inoue, I think that speaks for itself. Manami Toyota kind of speaks for itself. You see a pattern here. So they needed somebody new with credibility to take this title off of somebody from their promotion. And I would, if I was a betting man, I would think that whom else would come to mind? Emi Sakura, maybe? But she's busy doing her own thing.
I was about to say Emi Sakura, Haru Yoriyama, which I guess we would see much later. But it's like those other people that came to mind that sort of fit the criteria and were better wrestlers than Nanae. Like I said, a lot of what gave Nanae the edge at this point in time was who she knew and the fact that she could bank on the fact that, hey, I was the last red belt champion. I am friends with Aja Kong and Manami Toyota and Kyoko Inoue, and these people have my back, so put your belt on me. A lot of that is going on. A lot of backstage politics, which... Again, there's no confirmation. There's no 100% confirmation, but there is two things that have slipped out here and there. Obviously, the Kana stuff, stuff in Stardom's backstage. Nanae Takahashi is, if anything, a great politician backstage.
The people that play the game the best are on top the longest, one could say.
Yeah, just go ask Hunter.
Well, I mean, he's got his own sayings, you know. I forget where I read that, but it was an old wrestler from the 80s. And as we find out in our Nitro reviews, Kevin Nash is maybe even the best that ever did it.
Right, but two companies try at this point.
My God. So you bring up Kaori Yonayama. She's kind of in that same realm of Nene, right?
It's a better wrestler.
I think she's a better wrestler, especially in 2010.
There's no doubt she is a better wrestler at this point.
So we're in agreement there. This match is very strike heavy, and it's very power-based wrestling. And my interpretation of what was happening here is the whole objective is to get Nene Takahashi over as your new main eventer and see what she can do and carry the promotion to, I don't want to say bigger heights, but keep it afloat. That seems to be the mindset of how JWP is going. And
the mindset of the entire scene. Keep things afloat. Keep things at the very least at the status quo. Don't go any lower.
Yeah, no, nobody. And you know what? This brings up an interesting conversation because Nene Takahashi is a freelancer. I associate her with Neo just because of what's available, how much we can get a hold of. Why do you think that it's so difficult to get JWP material?
In the 2000s, the parent company would have a lot to do with that. Those unaware, JWP is two entities. It is JWP, the promotion. Then it is the parent company dubbed JWP Project. So when they split from each other, them and LLPW, JWP Project was founded with Jackie Sato and another businessman whose name escapes me. They formed JWP Project. Now, for a little while there, the parent company was the promotion. But they eventually, to sort of divvy things better financially, split it into two separate entities. One was the promotion, and one was the parent company. Sort of help restructure things financially for them. The parent company in the 2000s started making some really bad business choices. I'm talking like real estate business choices like HAW. I'm talking like merchandising rights and trying to get things like, I think at this point they were trying to hawk like CDs with their wrestlers singing from like the 90s. They were trying to hawk those on store shelves. Again, they were trying to like reprint them as like the greatest hits or something, and it just wasn't catching on. What's another one they were trying to do? There was like DVD compilations like we saw here that they were trying to hawk as like must-see things. They were trying to get some of this stuff, so these DVDs we're watching would have been bundled in with DVDs or some kind of picture book of like Ozaki and Cutie Suzuki and like those really steamy photo books, because they didn't have anyone on the roster at this point that could do that.
Steamy photo books, you say?
Oh, steamy photo books. Well, because in the 2010s,
are you interested in some steamy photo books with Nene Takahashi?
They exist. You joke.
There's an
they
image
exist.
For you.
They exist. You joke. They exist. At this point in the scene's life, in the scene's history, which is weird because I'm covering JD Star, which was doing some of this stuff earlier, and it was just being hammered and bashed for it by the rest of the scene, seeing as the skeevy stuff that's beneath them, and fast forward 2010, and that's kind of what's keeping some of the scene alive. But it's JWP was making a lot of dumb business moves, and they were pumping money into things. I think at one point they tried to start their own DVD label and try to license movies. The parent company did a lot to burn a lot of things down, and so as a result, it didn't produce a lot of wrestling DVDs because they didn't think there was no money in it. Really, nobody was buying them enough for them to see a profit. So, hey, screw it, let's just buy rights to movies and try to have those be licensed. Now, it wasn't like big movies, but they were like trying to get movies and license some of the smaller B movie stuff and put them out, mainly like shitty anime. Mm-hmm. Or hentai. They had like, they would go under different names, so you wouldn't know them as JWP Project. It would be like another name. I forget the shell company names they would go with, but it was. There's a reason why you can't find 2000 stuff. Just put it that way. Bad decisions. Dumb company.
There gives some perspective on how difficult it is to acquire these shows and why they're in compilation form all the time. But I also want to kind of bring up a topic that we're gonna mention a little bit on the Red Leaf Retrocast just main page as my cat does a run-in. Got to put him away.
A cat with a run-in. Okay, out of nowhere.
New mic's gonna get tested here.
cat's coming in out of nowhere.
Cat's coming in.
It's gonna KO.
Oh man. So again, we're going to talk about this a little bit on the Red Leaf Retrocast main podcast. Freelancers. The scene is not strong at this point in time. So there is a reliance on freelancers to pop houses, maintain, and keep afloat. And to that extent, you have an over-reliance on your veterans and veterans that are slowing down. There is also, my interpretation, of course, there is also an over-reliance from the bookers to keep putting themselves over to stay relevant. We're going to talk about that a little bit in Catch the Wave. Yes, that's very prominent with one Yumi Oka and company and another name of sorts. So here in JWP, you have the parent company that's an issue, but you still have that freelance reliance because you don't have rookies. You're not investing in yourself. The topic I want to expand upon now that I've set the stage is compared to today's wrestling, particularly from what we've seen from 2018 onwards, is now we have Stardom, whom invested in theirself and built up their own rookies and reliance and people staying. Yes, people come and go.
Signing people as well.
And signing people, because they have a strong backer, financial backer, and a trustworthy one in Bushiroad. Whether you think of them or not, they are a stable company. Not something say about JWP. Ice Ribbon has invested in themselves since essentially day one, and as we've covered on this podcast, yes, they do have, well, teenagers and children on their card, but they're investing in themselves nonetheless, whether you agree with their practices or not. That brought up a conversation on the previous episode, which I really enjoyed. And now we have Tokyo Joshi Pro, a strong backer, but instead of a reliance on freelancers, they went from day one, humble beginnings, to say the least, and they've built up a strong roster of signed talent, not freelancers. We look at JWP now, aka Pure J, Wave, Diana, Seedling, the list goes on. Oz Academy, well, 1,000% Oz Academy.
Yeah, there is no roster there. They have four people.
All of these rosters have one thing in common: a reliance on freelancers and very few of your own signed talent, and that over-reliance on that veteran presence that can't seem to accept their fate, to so say the least.
So, it's funny that you're bringing this topic up, and it's funny that we're going through this period of time right now. So, the way I like to think about it, the way I want to approach this is, at this point in time, the scene was in need of this. Not putting the people over, but in need of crossover. More so at this point than nowadays, just because the scene itself wasn't profitable and these wrestlers needed to get work and they needed to pop houses, and it was getting more and more hard. Now we're way out of the dark period. Like, we're just starting the dusk period, I would like to call this.
Yes, we're coming out of it.
We're coming out of the dark period. And I mean, you watched that 2001 JD Star show with me, and that's the dark period. That's like dingy basements, no crowd, really sketchy people involved, and that's the dark age.
Sign up for that $5 tier, and that's what you get.
Oh, yeah.
So fascinating.
That's where the scene is, like, at the lowest. It's at the pits. It's lower than the men's scene. Like, they couldn't even sell up bingo halls low. And at this point, they're coming out of that, and a lot of what's coming out of that is the up-and-coming Ice Ribbon, Neo getting exciting wrestling in front of people until they petered out because they couldn't maintain rookies or bring any rookies in. Weird thing about the scene at this point when it came to rookies was wrestling wasn't popular enough. They couldn't even really recruit women. They had to go out and have wrestlers put flyers on poles, try to get anyone to even look their way. That's how bad off they were. We're long since past AJW and JWP having lines outside their dojo for people to try out to be in the rookie in the dojo. We're long past that. We're at the point now where liking women's wrestling they're like seen as a skeevy pervert, and so you're not gonna get women come to your show as often, unless it's the hardcore ones that really are just there for your legends, which is why the legends are putting themselves over. To make it right, you're not making any new stars. It's in this weird spot where you can't always blame the legends for not putting themselves over, but it's the extent that they do it that kills things even worse.
It's the failure to evolve and get better. Cat running.
Well, I think when AJW closed, when that bubble burst, and then Gaia went too long after, the scene just like deflated. Like a balloon and just deflated, and that had a widespread effect on everybody. So, I point the collapse of the scene, or just Joshi in general, to AJW's collapse. Granted, things were pretty dingy and dark in 2001, and AJW was still around. Like, everything was low, but when that bubble popped finally, that half-deflated bubble that was AJW, it killed everything around it. Like, there was too many people, not enough work. There was no credibility. It was so bad off. And here in the 2010s, it's almost like it's weirdly better. And weird part is looking at modern day is half of the scene isn't that far removed from 2010.
And that's the problem, right? What we're seeing right now in this context in 2010 with the JWP Openweight title, Nene versus Hariyama, this is considered what you had to do, right? Over time, the industry changes and gets better. That's the goal, anyways. It's supposed to get better, and you're supposed to evolve with it, or you're left behind. So, the promotions I named before, your Pure J is a great example of this. Without continuing to support yourself and having the means to do so, I hate to say it, but your fate is to close. Or join up and continue to at least try to come out and see what other companies are doing and get better that way. What I have an issue with What I'm curious is, and this is where we're going to talk about, this is what we're going to talk about on the Redleaf Retrocast, is what I'm curious is these freelancers, your Hiroyo Matsumoto's is a great example. She's been a freelancer forever. What is her mindset going to be? Is it going to be finally become the big star, like last ditch kind of end of her era, to sign with a Stardom, a TJ, just throwing this out there, Kay, sign with a Stardom or TJPW, or do a Sauriano where join an Ice Ribbon, don't sign a contract, but you're committed to Ice Ribbon. You're going to be a good soldier and grow with that promotion, your DIY. Because we see that with your Dragon Gate, DIY, New Japan, signed a ton of talent and developed their own talent, your Stardom. And your DDT, TJPW kind of speaks for itself. What is the mindset going to be of these freelancers that have been doing this for so long? Is it going to continue freelancing and kind of bounce around these low-end promotions, show up on a Wave show, show up on a Pure J show, show up on a Body Girl Kaliga show? Or is it going to be help the next generation, maybe get a couple last runs in with a tag title, make a splash in your Stardom, or simply just fade away? I'm very curious to see that, because now seeing what we're seeing now in 2010s covering this puts a good perspective on what we're going to see or not see is also interesting in 2021.
Right. Well, when you mentioned Hiroyo, I think the scene's already long since passed her. She had her chance. She blew it, whether it be her on her own choice or just not knowing how to capitalize on her momentum. She blew it. Scene's passed her. Stardom probably won't even look her direction at this point. Ice Ribbon doesn't bring her in at all, even as a one-off anymore. Haven't done so for years. TJPW doesn't have a need for. She doesn't even fit their aesthetic.
Well, that's what I'm saying. She's done. So she's going to be popping around these lower promotions.
She's doomed to it. She's doomed to that existence. Yeah. Right. I also want to mention one thing. The names that were sort of floundering and barely holding things up at this point, those same names are the same ones we just discussed. Kyoko Inoue, Diana. Nanai Takahashi, Seedling. Beyond, Command Bolshoi. J. Those Wave, Oka, Hada, Gami. They didn't learn, and that's why those promotions are doomed to never grow. I don't think a Wave or a Pure J or a Diana or even Seedling, which seems to be the only one of the companies that seems to get sort of some pop up here and there with notoriety here every so once in a while compared to the other ones. They're not going to survive because they're never going to grow. And eventually the scene's going to be too big for them and they're going to be left behind. Left behind so much that they won't be able to last. I can't see a Seedling or a Pure J or a Wave. I can't see them being acquired by any of the other bigger companies. One, Iceman's not big enough to do something like that financially. Two, why the hell would Bushiroad buy them? Their talent's not worth it. Maybe they'd buy a few talent here and there, but not the entire roster. Why would Cyber Agent buy them? They don't fit.
No, they've grown since 2015 what those three promotions have done to really separate themselves from the rest of the scene. And in contrast, we have Sendai, Marvelous, and Oz Academy. I'm gonna throw those three promotions out.
I was Sendai.
Let's face it. The scene is split among way too many promotions with way too small roster sizes, and the freelancers are depleting, okay? So where does that leave Sendai, Marvelous, and Oz Academy? It leaves them on an island of their own with a, not a glass ceiling, a concrete ceiling.
I'd go far, I'd say... say a steel ceiling. They're never going to get past that ever. And with Sendai, and I meant to mention this a little bit during my little tirade, Sendai is never going to grow. So much so that the only way for them to get out of their current situation is to sell themselves to WWE. Think about that. That's their only option. They're not going to grow past the farm. They're not going to leave the Sendai pit, which a pit's a perfect example. Perfect name for the
farm.
Place they wrestle in.
They're stuck on the
Sendai
farm.
Sendai Pit's the name of the venue that they frequent a lot.
Oh, really?
Sendai
how appropriate.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. How oddly appropriate for a promotion like Sendai. The only people I ever hear talk about Sendai is people who don't want to like the popular stuff, and so they like the stuff that'll never be popular. Sendai is a promotion that still runs shows, but it's a dead promotion as the rest of the scene is concerned.
Yeah, I've seen conversations begin with... what would have happened to Sendai if, say, Kagetsu and a few other people had stayed? And
they would be exactly where Miko Wada, Chihiro Hashimoto, and Dash Sakura. Ask them
yes,
where
exactly.
they are at.
If you just see how much the promotion has not grown and stayed the way it has since the company's beginning, it'd be the same. There'd be no change.
There's a reason they left. There's a reason why Ryo Mizunami left, Kagetsu left, and even Andres. There's a reason why they left. They were going to go nowhere, ever, in that promotion. That promotion, the reason why that promotion failed isn't because it's talent. It has a lot of really good talent. Dash Sock was amazing. Iwata's
yeah, the same
great.
With Marvelous. A lot of
Chihiro
really good talent.
Chihiro should be a freaking megastar harkening back to the 80s. Style of presentation and wrestling. They suck and they fail because Meiko Satomura is directing that ship and she can't direct a paper bag. She can't direct something in a paper bag. She can't do anything. She is a failure as a promoter. So is Chigusa. I love Chigusa. We all can say that we love Chigusa. She has said so much for the industry. She is literally the biggest name in all of women's wrestling, West or East. Her name holds so much value to those that know it and those that matter. She has got so much sway. She sucks as a promoter. Gaia was only able to survive because of the names in it, not because of its direction.
Right.
And Marvelous has floundered. It's done nothing with itself. Kumi Aroha is a fantastic talent. Damn it, she feels like nothing. She feels a bigger star when she shows up in Stardom than she does in her own promotion.
Right. I hate to bring it up. Well, I hate for people to realize finally that you brought up Chihiro Hashimoto should be a megastar.
He should
where
be.
Where she's at, that steel ceiling you mentioned just can't be broken through. And the same thing goes for Takumi Aroha. And as
it's
much as I love watching her, she'll have her two matches in Stardom. She'll have her match in Seedling or whatever. There's a ceiling to it all. You can have your good match every once in a while. But what do you bring? What do you actually... I forget where I mentioned this. Might have been the last episode. Might have been talking about Sari when we were going on the Ice Ribbon rant. At the end of the day, they bring a small pop for one night, and they go away. And eventually, the promotion themselves won't need them anymore for anything like that. Unless the whole objective is to pop one house for one night once a year. And hey, more power to you. But in the long run, they don't need you.
Right. And I think the weird thing is when you look at those three stars you mentioned, right? Or two stars, and I'll mention a third one in a sec. Chihiro Hashimoto, Meiko Satomura's protege, should be a big fucking deal. It's nothing. She doesn't matter. She's hit that ceiling and has been at that ceiling for so long, it's too late for her.
God, it's felt like 8 years she's been in that same
position. It's been 8 years. At least it should be. It feels like it, right? Takumi Aroha, Chigusa Nagayo's protege.
That's
biggest name.
That's at least 6 years at this point, right?
Biggest name. Something like that. The biggest name in women's wrestling. She's the protege of her. She's not a big deal. She feels like a big deal once in a while, but that's going to fade. I think the only one is the third one to mention, Yoshiko, Nanai Takahashi's protege. She's the only one that has any small chance of breaking out of that ceiling on her own. She has to leave Seedling for that. If Stardom signed her, she'd be great. She'd make it, right? Problem is, I don't see that ever happening because of the history. They probably wouldn't offer her a contract. Even if it's all smooth over at this point, I just can't see them offering a contract. They'll let her pop on a show, but I doubt they'll sign her.
She'll and the Stardom Budokan show coming up is a great example of what we're talking about here. Stardom's objective is to get their name on the map, run in Budokan, and they need to pop a big house for it. So this is when the freelancers make their mark, right? Yeah. The promotion is using them for that one night pop, and the objective is then for the promotion to get over further and make Utami, in this case, feel like the bigger star, and Mayu and Momo, and as soon as that bell rings, win or lose. Like, let's say Nene and Yoshiko both win. As soon as that bell rings and they leave the ring, Stardom's washing their hands and they're gone. Right?
Might be a rematch to run it back, and then they'll squash both of them, and then they'll really wash their hands of it.
Right. It's just like Takumi Aroha's two houses she popped in 2020.
It was supposed to be just be one.
And it was supposed to
Remember,
be just one.
That was supposed to be Sari.
Right. It's just a one or two night thing. And then we're done with it. And the rest of the year is focused on Stardom and their wrestlers. So, that's the big long topic. What happened in this Nene Takahashi, Kayoko Hariyama title match? Run it back. Well, they beat the hell out of each other. The crowd was really into it. Both people hit their finishers. They kicked out. And it led to a nice little finish, I think, albeit a little bit less dramatic than they probably had intended. It was a hoss fight for 2010 JWP. I think this is a good example of two wrestlers that have power, have a presence in the scene at the time. Are they the top workers of the scene? I don't think so. I think they're kind of in that same... I think Yoshiko Tamura has a bigger... presence than both of these women, but nonetheless, Hariyama does a couple cool things in this match. I like her leg lariats that she does. She does a top rope leg lariat leg drop, the neck, which got a real good pop out of me. She goes to the top again, and Nene Takahashi kind of stomps her, punches her in the head, gets her up for a muscle buster position, but she gives her a nice little Falcon driver, if you will, and pins her. Ends the 719-day reign. So, whether or not you wanted Hariyama or Takahashi to win, I think if you were following JWP at the time, you were very satisfied with the match and the result, no matter who you wanted to win or lose.
Because at least it brought a fresh direction to what was probably very stagnant at the time for
right.
the very few people that followed their shows every time they ran them. The crowd audibled when she won. There was a little bit of a gasp.
Oh, yeah. So when we look at what happened for the next few months, Nene Takahashi was challenged by Bolshoi, beat her in June. She goes 2 months without a defense. So I think that's a failure on JWP to not capitalize. One thing I always like in a promotion is they don't take long for the next defense of a new champion. It's just bang, new champion. Let's get a good defense in there. Let's establish our new champion as a draw. I think JWP waited too long at this point in time. And if you look at if you research some of the houses, business goes down a little bit because of this.
I think it was also because Nanai wasn't a much of a draw. Her matches weren't as good.
They found out very quick that Nanai Takahashi was not the answer for JWP. Because she's a freelancer, and the audience is not totally familiar with her. That's my interpretation.
Because she's not tied to the promotion that they're following. They're following right. JWP. They're not following Nanai Takahashi outside of JWP. So she didn't show up on every show. So as a result, they weren't as invested in her.
And you mentioned the title defenses.
You mentioned the title defenses. They fell back on their old traditions of not having frequent defenses. I mean, go look at the defense records for every champion. Long periods of time, so many days held, three defenses. It's an old school mindset that thankfully has changed in the scene for the promotions that it matters in. I mean, you know, Tokyo Joshi Pro, maybe here and there, they don't do every month title defenses, but they do them frequently enough to where it matters and they feel like a big deal when they do them. This is a joke. It's like, yeah, you have the belt for 700 days, but you defended it twice.
Yuki Miyazaki is another defense that happens a week later. So it's almost like she was down for just a simple tour. They go another month. And she goes against Kaori Yoneyama in what seems to be a very good match. And Yoneyama wins the title, a JWP rep. And they puts the former champion over herself from the old promotion there. And Yoneyama, for all intents and purposes, is very over with the crowd. She's got a good, very interesting over look to her. And the crowd, more importantly, cares about her. This is why she ends up having the title for quite some time, and I can't wait to talk about a particular defense later on this Patreon episode for the Ridley Frederickcast. One Emi Sakura match that we do have full access to.
A career-defining match for both.
Yes.
The Oniyama, she was already over with their audience because she had been known for... She was about as long as Bolshoi almost, I think. Like, they had been around in JWP for a long, long time. And she was already like... So, I guess for those unaware, because I guess we have to break it down at this point, because there's people that probably don't know who Kaori Yoneyama is. They know what Gokugen Death is, and Death Yama-san. Kaori Yoneyama, nowadays, is, I'd say, a shell of herself. I think that's intentional to keep her career going, much like when Renmaru, as I would find out in my JD Star show, Renmaru used to be a serious ninja-kicking wrestler. And now she's a comedy act. I think with Yoneyama, at this point, she was already so good. The only thing going against her was her size. She was just so short, and so not every company was taking a chance on her, but JWP was constantly giving her stuff to do. Because she was so over. She was so good. She could interact with the crowd. She had great crowd connection, which they desperately needed. And she was already really good in the ring and got the crowd excited for everything she did.
I'm looking forward to the Yoneyama run. what we can get out of that one match in particular. So very interesting transition of power here. Relying on a freelancer, business goes down, then it goes back up. You put one over yourself. And I'm gonna find out if I can do a little research on what happened with Bolshoi and Leon, because they're two originals themselves and they're still in the promotion. I'm wondering why they weren't pushed as a bigger commodity. But maybe we'll see that as we continue on this journey.
So I can get to something brief about that that I know.
Okay.
Bolshoi, I believe at this point, has the book.
Ah, interesting.
And I don't think she gets a title reign until the end of her career. I could be mistaken, but I remember them making a big deal that she finally won the Pure J belt. I don't think she ever held the JWP belt. I could be wrong. I could probably look it up on the fly if I wanted to.
No. Let's continue this on. We've been going a little bit longer, but that was the good chunk of the podcast here. Let's move on to the Neo 10th Anniversary Show, aka Neo Spectacle in Seiche Korakuen, May 5th, 2010. Yes, this is Neo Women's Pro Wrestling. Don't worry, people. There's more promotions out there than Neo.
Yes. Also, she held it in 2015. It's the only reign she had the JWP version of the belt with no defenses.
That is very interesting to me.
Held it for a little over a month and lost it.
That is very interesting, because she seemed to have a connection in a couple of matches that we saw. That's super interesting. We'll have to have a topic over Bolshoi and Leon at some point.
Definitely.
So yes, Korakuen Hall, attendance 976 at this Neo show. More than the JWP, mind you.
Yes.
The main event was a 30-person Royal Rumble filled with comedy characters, veterans, and a hilarious heat beatdown on 13-year-old Riho.
That was about the only highlight of the match, to be fair. That's
very funny.
So odd that was the main event. That's the second time I think we've seen them do something like that, right? When they have had a main event battle royal instead of just a match.
I believe they had a battle royal like in the undercard-ish. But yeah. They tend to go to that battle royal part quite a bit to kind of pop a house. Seems to be their go-to. But we're here to talk about the Neo tag title match. Ayumi Kurihara, someone I have very much gravitated to. She's tag champions with Yoshiko Tamura, who is also the top champion in Neo. They're taking on the team of freelancer Hiroyo Matsumoto and Misaki Hata, someone we're going to learn about a lot on this journey. I believe this is the first time we've seen her. I'm vaguely familiar with the name, because I came into Joshi Wrestling to a loose extent, and then by the time I super got into it, Misaki Owada's career was coming to an end.
But here she is. That would be 2018, yeah.
Yes.
Because she retired in 2018.
Yes, exactly. And I didn't know what a wave was.
Oh, but I did.
Yeah, I came in with Stardom, and that was kind of Stardom. Checked out a Sendai show. Anyways, getting off topic. Kay, where does Misaki Owada hail from? Where was she trained, and what year was this?
So, Misaki Owada is one JD star. I believe it was 2003. Hold up real quick.
While you look that up, Ayumi Kurihara came from the same academy as Kana, which kind of attributes to her style and ring movement and presence situation. Do we know the background of Hiroyo?
I can look that up too if you want. On top of my head, no, but I do know she's been freelance her entire career. Ohada debuted in 2006, the last year-ish of JD Star. She was the last class of rookie. It would close in 2007. She would debut the end of 2006.
Okay. So?
Hiroyo. So she's from JD Star.
Yep.
So Hiroyo? One second.
Bear with us, folks.
Miss Matsumoto-san. 2006.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be right back. Something's going off. I'll be right back.
All right, well, I'll go over this tag title match then. So, the Neo tag title match between Ayumi Kurihara and Tamura, they defeat the team of Hiroya Matsumoto and Misaki Oda. Now, this is from a Neo DVD that we have, and this brings in another interesting point. These are two outsiders challenging for the title. And, yeah, Kurihara is a freelancer herself, and so is Tamura to an extent, but they basically represent Neo as well. I kind of associate them with the Nene Takahashi situation here, and even Emi Sakura to an extent. Emi Sakura kind of bounces around a few promotions, pops up here and there.
So, I am back. I am back. I apologize for that. I had an alarm go off.
That's fine.
I also, while I did that, I also looked at where Hiroyo Matsumoto came from. She debuted in Ibuki, a promotion in 2006 that very little is sort of documented on that I could find. Right, real quick as we sat here. So she debuted in Ibuki. Her first match was against Mai Ichi to a time draw.
Oh no.
The first promotion outside of Ibuki that she would go to is BJW.
There you go. Big Japan wrestling right there. All right. So this match kind of opened my eyes to a couple things. Yoshika Tamura, she should be... I understand why they retained the tag titles here. Because these are two outside freelancers that are coming in for a good match. And a good match they gave us. There's no doubt in my mind of that. What popped into my head is Tamura needs to put someone over. Right? She needs to get in there and put over a new star. Especially because she's on her way out. And we've seen this time and time again on the All Japan women journey. You don't go out at the last second. You got to put someone over months prior. We have evidence that that's what works best. So maybe on this day, Tamura should have been pinned, set up a title match. Yeah, you could beat her, put over someone you really want to get over, someone who's more affiliated with the promotion. We kind of see this tactic used in Seedling a little bit. You know, tag title.
All right.
Yeah.
I'll say this about Tamura. There was nobody in Neo to put over. They had no rookies. Everyone there was already established or a freelancer.
Right. That's why the person I bring up, she put maybe over, Hiroyo should have pinned her. Maybe Misaki Iwata.
The person she put over was Tsukasa Fujimoto.
Is that in 2010?
She retires in 2010.
Yeah, I realize that, but did she get pinned in 2010 from Tsukasa?
I believe so, because she passed on her ace crusher to her. Okay. Would usually facilitate her being pinned by her.
So, what was revealed to me is you have three young wrestlers here that are clearly very over with the crowd. Ayumi Kurihara, when she hits that fucking T-bone suplex, crowd pops. When Misaki Oda hits those rolling, quick pins that, okay, from all the wrestling we've seen on this journey, whether it's a Meiko Satomura, especially a Nene, Hariyama, she stands out and is so different in her style. The crowd, and myself included, very much gravitate to her. Hiroya Matsumoto, she's kind of that old style. She's that 2000s hard-hitting power style that we see a lot of. She could maybe replace someone else on top. So we have three young wrestlers, clearly with a lot of talent, with three different styles in this match that I think could have set the precedent and possibly not. I don't think I think saving Neo is beyond saving at this point with their vision. But going forward in other promotions, God, I can't wait to talk about that Catch the Wave tournament.
right.
Going forward in other promotions, getting people like this over is super important. Freelancer or not, because they're all freelancers. So, how much do you think, let's just put a hypothetical out there, how much do you think this would have helped, maybe Neo, but let's say JWP needs someone to go up against, Yonayama, Nene, whomever, right? If Hiroyo got the pin here, Ohada, Kurihara maybe gets a good victory over someone later. It all stems from this tag title match. Do you think that would have helped the scene advance further? Or do you think there was just no saving it?
No, there was no saving it. Especially Neo at this point, they were doomed.
I'm talking like a JWP. Doomed. Getting new stars, new fresh stars in there instead of relying on old talent all the time.
No, it wouldn't have saved it because it weren't home talent. And so the fans, as we saw with Nai, wouldn't care as much.
But you can bring them in and introduce them and get them on the cards more often. And because they're bigger stars, because of pins like this, they can protect themselves further. You get what I'm going with?
No, I get what you're going with. Yeah. I think the problem here is you would put one person over or two people over in a scene full of people that are not put over. It's like dropping a stone in a pond. It really wouldn't have made a difference. The problem with the scene was it was so much of that that it would have required, at this point in the scene, would have required a collective effort of pushing all the young talent all at once to revitalize anything, and none of these promotions were going to take that gamble. The reason why Stardom got successful when it started doing that in later in the 2000s, the 2010s, the reason why Ice Ribbon at this point is popular and is maintaining a fan base and gaining a fan base because they're pushing new people. Riho, people are like, oh yeah, what's this Riho person?
She's this 13-year-old main eventing Korakuen Hall. That's interesting.
I've not seen her. What's this Tsukasa Fujimoto person? She's cool. I've not seen her for the past 20 years.
Well, that's why I bring up these three talents here. These are young talents that have, for all intents and purposes, developed to an extent to be the next main event stars. And yet...
Ohada would later in her career become a main event star, and that was more building up a rapport and over time.
Right, right.
I know what happens with Hiroyo.
But by then it's kind of too late. Hiroyo's the same way. It should be, like, what we're seeing now in crowd reaction in this match, it should be now. Not later, not 5 years later. It should be right now.
It should be. You're not wrong. I would have liked them to put them over. The problem is they were never going to do that. And even if they had, I don't know if it would have done anything. At this point, the only way for the scene to have grown was exactly what ended up happening for the scene to get to where it is now. New promotions with new mindsets and new talent being produced from said promotions to be put over.
The slow process to get them over. Instead of relying on those freelancers.
Right, because at this point, these freelancers are done. They've lost for at least 5 years, some of them. So in the eyes of the audience, they're already losers. They've lost so much and have done so little. After 5 years, you've seen Ohada just go from a dying promotion doing nothing to doing nothing in the rest of the scene. So why would you ever get behind her, even if she started winning now? Why would you be able to believe that she could do anything? The problem was the scene did that for so many people that there's a reason why I say Kana's biggest historical claim to her career, the biggest thing she ever did in her career, was protect Io and Mio.
And then later leave those two people, and set a precedent that you can make it outside the scene.
Right. Like Io and Mio being protected. Yeah, Io and Mio being protected as young as they were and as talented as Io Shirai fucking was very, very important, because that scene would have devoured Io especially. She wouldn't have survived. She would just be like, well, like Ohada here. Oh, you lost for 5 years. Cool, you do some flashy cool shit, but you don't win anything, and if you started winning things, I wouldn't believe that you could anyways.
Right.
You lost for 5 years and done nothing for 5 years, so who are you?
The fate of WCW. That's a great example of that.
That's actually perfect. That's a perfect one for one. Scene right now is WCW of the 2000s. Nobody's over except the old people, and even they're barely over at this point.
Right, you can only push them for so long. So this tag match was fucking awesome. I loved it.
It was great.
It's AJW go-go-go style at its best, with crazy double-team moves and everyone hitting their signature moves for near falls. Misaki Owada's roll-through Joshi rolls are super over with the crowd because she's so different and unique to that old power style that a lot of the wrestlers have, because they're all trained seemingly by the same scene people, except JD Star people. They are the unique ones, and we'll get into a lot of JD Star Fallout wrestlers, which is very interesting. So,
yeah, especially with that Catch the Wave tournament, I think we'll be discussing a lot of that there.
Oh my god, I can't wait. So, Tamura and Kurihara. Kurihara Ohada, that sequence was amazing between the suplexes and quick roll-ups. That got over really well. They really work incredibly well together. I really hope to see something more out of them, but I have a feeling we won't. And Hiroyo just... I think she was kind of hanging out with Tamura, you know, kind of going at it, doing their thing. But the finish was excellent. I really liked it. Tamura and Kurihara take care of Hiromu, kind of chuck her outside. They do that crazy reverse tombstone muscle buster situation. That's not even the finish, but Kurihara does pin Ohada with the hammerlock T-bone suplex, which is a really cool finisher. Good match. I do recommend it. It's kind of cut out because of the DVD, but you can definitely get into it nonetheless.
I'd give it a 3, actually, to think about it. I like the match a lot, though. Maybe because it's the first time we talk about Ohada, I'd give it a 3. Just go watch her, what she does, because Ohada's so good. It's a shame that the scene didn't recognize that properly until way later. Like, almost when it was too, like you had said. Kind of a shame, really.
Yeah, I give this match an easy 2-star recommendation out of the 3. It's not going to get a highly recommended. I still think that Passion Red Kurihara Tamura match, that's kind of the standard that's set for a high-level tag match of high recommendation standard from myself. You have a slightly different opinion than me, Kay. That's okay.
Right. Well, I think mine leans a little differently. I think sometimes it's the first time we talk about somebody, I recommend it so that they can go see them for the first time as we talk about them later.
Sure. That's the state there. And then our last one is just a simple little intergender match. It's from Shinkiba. It's Revolution Amendola Rasta Color Under the Moon. It's got a wacky produce name. It's Aja Kong teaming with Magnitude Kishiwada. They're taking on the team of Kyoko Kimura and Muniori Sawa. I just kind of want to mention that Kyoko Kimura here, 2010 versus 2010 Aja Kong. Just a nice little mention. Is a fun match that we found. It's not really anything totally deep dive into, other than it's interesting to see Aja Kong still move in 2010, and then how fast she just kind of just loses mobility as one would, you know, going from 40 years old to 50 years old as time goes on. And how over she still is with the crowd, but she's running this little Shinkiba show. It's like, I get the feeling Aja Kong's like, yeah, I put in my work in the 90s. I was in Gaia in the 2000s. Now I'm just going to kick it around and enjoy myself and freelance it up. Nothing wrong with that for Aja Kong. She's put in the work to do that, and she's not running a promotion burying people.
No, I think Aja Kong, even looking at it in current day, Aja Kong is the perfect legend. She puts people over when she needs to. She also puts rookies over by just having a match with her. And if she squashes them, the fact that they survived Aja Kong is seen as a bit of a rub and a push in the scene, and by fans in general. And she's not running a promotion, so she's not burying people. Cough, cough, Ozaki, cough, cough.
Yeah, and she protects herself to the extent that if she gets a big main event, she can put people over, and it just makes her bulletproof to damage, right?
I mean, just her legacy. If she lost like 6 matches in a row, she's still Aja fucking Kong.
Right.
So.
And then she kicks it around in mid-card tag matches, doesn't get pinned, she gets her spots in. It's fine. It's totally fine. She's a great example. Now, Kyoko Kimura, mother of Hana Kimura, very important in the scene now from unfortunate circumstances, but she had her own kind of small mark on the industry in the 2010s. She was kicking it around with, I guess, Mima Shimoda's crew. That we saw Neo kind of pop up, and this gangster heel type group faction that went around. What is the history behind Kyoko Kimura at this point?
So at this point, she's just starting to get things together. I think she was a late bloomer in terms of wrestling. Mm-hmm. I forget when she started off the top of my head. I know she was a bit late in, the thing with Kyoko Kimura, and I don't want this to come off as insulting in any way, because it's not meant to, she's seen as much more important than she kind of was to the scene as a whole. I think most of her impact comes a lot more in hardcore matches, and then later on being a really good heel. Being a crazy batshit heel that was able to get faces over very well, but she was never a main event sort of put the belt on star, and the scene never treated her like that. She was kind of in the Dump Matsumoto role. She's the big heel, big burly monster that you want to use to put your faces over. And that's what we would see Ice Ribbon do, and we'd see Stardom do the exact same thing when she came in there and had Kimura Monster Goon.
And that's totally fine.
I think between her and, obviously, unfortunately, Hana Kimura, given what happened with her, I think Hana Kimura was primed to be the much bigger star.
Oh, absolutely.
I think that's why her mom was so firmly behind her. Because, like, yes, go be bigger than me. It's unfortunate how that all ends. But I think at this point, Kyoko is just kind of just playing the indies. She doesn't really have a huge role yet. And she doesn't really have a small role either. She's just kind of in the middle right now. And the group she's a part of, she's not really the leader of it. Shimoda, that is.
Yeah, she's doing this freelance produce show role. She doesn't come across as a star at all. She does have a presence to her, but it's more of her uniqueness. I mean, she's got the half-buzzed head. She's got a big heart in the side of her head. She's got a unique look to her. Aja Kong put her over to an extent that Aja Kong gave her a lot of offense, got her a lot of trials and chances to come back, get her stuff in, and make a mark for herself as Kyoko Kimura. Bring some individuality to her. And I think the crowd responded well enough to what she was able to bring. She does eat the pin eventually to Aja Kong. There was a lot of wacky double team moves, keeping the match going. She took the top rope elbow that Kong does. Not the second rope that she does now. Aja Kong was still going to the top rope at this time. And eats a back fist, and, you know, the match was over. I wasn't impressed in ring with Kyoko Kimura, but it's good to see kind of where she started and how she's gonna come into her own, because she's not the big heel yet.
No, she debuted in 2003. She was trained by Bolshoi, actually.
Huh, how about that?
Yeah, that was interesting. I just looked that up. She started in JWP, actually.
Well, there you go.
That was her home promotion. That was home promotion for her first entire year, and then she would branch out a little bit later on. So at this point, she is very much is an indie sort of freelance wrestler, because she stops going to JWP. This whole through 2010, she doesn't show up there at all.
And that brings this episode to a close. Okay, I hope we had a good conversation and the people listening learned a lot and could form their own opinions over the information that was spoken about today.
Right, I mean, as you could hear it in my tone, I tend to get frustrated when talking about the stagnation of the scene, because it should be so much better than it is. But it was a good conversation, yeah.
Again, if you want to get these episodes 2 weeks earlier, head on over to the Patreon, Red Leaf Retrocast, $1.50 tier. If you want even more material from us, like K's JD Star episodes, my Starcades, and among other things, that's what the $5 tier is for. We do also have wrestler rankings from the year that coincide with the regular podcast. That's also free, but the wrestler rankings are nice little extra stuff for the $1.50 tier. For that, so you do get extra little content. Not willing to spend the $5. This was episode 5 of the 2010s, and we're, I guess everyone's probably familiar with Big Egg Joshi at this point, if you're this far into the podcast.
Yes. So I just want to tack on a little extra message for those listening on the Big Egg Joshi feed. There's a bit of a break that's going to start happening. I'm trying to reorganize how I'm going to do the podcast. I do want to get that Tam Nakano episode out before I do that. Just be a little patient, and there's a new direction I'm sort of taking the podcast in, one that's a little less taxing on me, because I hold myself such a higher standard or put such a higher workload on myself whenever I do these in-depth career episodes. So just be patient, please.
And with that, see you next time.
See ya.